Meisner, room 3.
Thank you very much. I think as we assembled there, it was just seemed to be a nice and enthusiastic outing. October is dull, but quite pleasant time still in Hungary, and not very cold, and it seemed just an interesting way of spending an afternoon. Certainly, on the way to the band here, none of us could have realized the likely outcome of that demonstration. And even at the band here, where there were so many of us listening to the points made, we realized that these had been points which had been spelled out on several meetings of the different groups of intellectuals who had met. Theodore Louis-Schein, the literary magazine, and others had been popularizing some of these views already. They didn't just emerge on that day. But even that, when people were approving these points, we didn't realize. It was only when we were walking back on the bridge and we suddenly realized that Prime Minister Geru had arrived back from Yugoslavia and had called us a fascist demonstration, that really the feelings have changed. It was no longer just a feeling of wanting to influence this particular Prime Minister and this particular government, but it was suddenly a change that these people don't understand the way we see things, they don't understand who we are, they don't understand the popular feeling. They are completely out of touch with reality, and hence it's going to be more. But even then, if anybody had asked me that, do you think that tonight there is going to be some change, I wouldn't have realized. And even when the bodies were brought in from the radio building, from the shooting, even then, I'm just sure that this was one of those things. I think the real realization of the strengths of the position and the weakness of the government came when these Hungarian tanks appeared, and it became clear that the chaps standing in the tanks were not going to support the secret police and the government. And that's an amazing situation when the army comes out and it doesn't support the regime. And it was a fascinating thing next day to see it, to see it forward, to see it fall so completely. As I told you, I think the feelings were divided. There were those who felt worried because any destabilization, as you said, certainly Jewish circles, could have easily made people feel that they were in imminent danger. But I think by this time this regime was so desperately unpopular and everybody was so much against it, and it seemed quite amazing. They had no friends. And as far as I could see, I couldn't identify anybody who was feeling for them. I was looking for them, and I could actually think of one or two people. But there were very few, and those who spoke for it, the few sort of sports journalists on the radio, the few artists, I really don't think that they could have been in favor of that particular regime. That particular regime by that time had lost all support. The question was that how far could the revolution go? I didn't feel, from my experience, that the revolution at any time exceeded the limits of where I would have been able and willing to go along with it. Now, I wasn't very much aware of this lynching the secret police people in secret police headquarters. This didn't really have wide popularity in Budapest at the time. I mean, I would have thought that it might have spread as a rumor which would have come round straight away. But funnily enough, I heard of that once I had already left Hungary, which was quite interesting. That although I was there in Budapest at the time, I hadn't heard of that. But I would have thought that, although I didn't know very much about it, I don't think it would have upset as many people as all that, because after all, There was a certain amount of lynching in 1945 when some of the fascists were rounded up, and I remember seeing some of them hung on the trees in 1945, and I certainly don't think that there was any feeling of horror about that as much as there might have been in some ways. But in a way, it was a pity not to have been able to control that, looking back on the events, because certainly it may have given to the few remaining Hungarian communists and perhaps to the Russians some feeling about the morality of their intervention, which I wish hadn't been there. Having said that, I understand that some of the Russians were looking for the Suez Canal cave. They were geographically and politically disoriented, and which is an unfortunate reflection on the standard of education and political sophistication of the participants of the Russian armed forces. But I'm told that that was a case at the time.
Why should the engineering faculty have taken such a lead?
Oh, I think where the nuclei were of the movement, I mean, basically the nuclei of the important political thought were mainly the writers and others who were the intellectuals behind it. But I think the engineering faculty was a hot house of dissatisfaction. There was no particular reason why it shouldn't have been the medical faculty, it should have been the engineering or science faculty.
Had you listened to Western broadcasts?
Yes, all the time. I mean, it was an established habit in Hungary to do so. Perhaps I didn't listen enough. I mean, I wasn't egged on as much as some people were, who felt that there was imminent Western help coming. I think we just felt happy about the efforts as they went. The situation changed from day to day, and it seemed to stabilize with the coming of Imre Nagy. But certainly one did realize that there were demands made on the government that perhaps they weren't, Imre Nagy and others weren't sufficient change. And I think Imre Nagy recognized this when he was asking for neutrality, which was funnily enough not part of the requests in the initial points which were raised at our demonstration. There was no question of going as far as that at that time. But Imre Nagy made the requests for neutrality, which as day by day the demands increased on them.
What did you listen to yourself?
Well, I think there was enough Hungarian news on the Hungarian radio. There was no television, of course, at that time, which is quite interesting. So it was sound radio, and talking to each other, going to meetings at the university, which was going on. And the meetings were interesting. I didn't make all the speeches. I asked questions, I think, from the others who were making them. But it became very clear that we were heading for a break with the Soviet Union. We were heading for demanding from government neutrality. I think my own thoughts in political terms were at that time certainly were not towards trying to re-establish a capitalist regime at that time, and there were no thoughts of free markets in my mind. I think we were thinking of a liberal, socialist, neutral state, independent of the Soviet Union, of the Warsaw Pact, and not necessarily in any way identified, say, with Western capitalism of the United Kingdom or of the United States, but more a position like Austria, which was a kind of a neutral country with a vaguely socialist regime. You see, this would have been too big a jump for us at that time to take from the points of view that we had, and with the upbringing that we had in the last years of communism. It was quite a big enough jump to say that we want social democracy instead of communism. Interesting, because of course now in the distance of 40 years, one wonders why hadn't we jumped straight away the whole hog of wanting to see a liberal capitalism resuscitated. Certainly it didn't occur to me at that time to think in those terms.
It would certainly have given ammunition to the Russians, wouldn't it? If you had come out in those terms.
Well, I think thinking back now, that's what has precipitated the few defecting members of the Hungarian government to ask for Russian help, and what precipitated eventually Mr. Khrushchev and the Russian High Command to make up their minds that they were going to go the whole hog and come in and put the revolution down by their tanks and drown it in blood. It must have been that I think people were probably becoming paranoid that the communists would have been liquidated and held responsible for the extremely oppressive regime which they had run. And they probably weren't going to face that sum. So they rather let the Hungarian side down and vote in the Russians to put the revolution down than risk their fellow communists being taken to task.
Which Western radio stations did you listen to?
I mainly listened to the BBC, and because of that, I didn't hear those broadcasts which some of my fellow countrymen blame for some of the extreme actions that they take in continuing fighting, because those who listened to Radio Free Europe felt, and certainly in retrospect, they felt that they were egged on to take action which perhaps they wouldn't have taken if they hadn't thought that imminent military help was going to come. I must say that the BBC was objective and there was no promise of anything that wasn't going to materialize. I mean, they could see that they gave a fairly accurate and non-partisan assessment of what was happening, and I'm really proud of now, in retrospect, of the BBC, that it didn't encourage things that it had no justification to encourage.
Were you listening to the BBC during the revolutionary events?
I listened to it during, and I listened to the Hungarian broadcasting during. Now, don't forget, the Hungarian broadcasting during was a perfectly realistic forum of what was happening, and people were able to give their views, people were talking. It wasn't an oppressive situation. I think the government, once they took over the Hungarian radio from the communists, they had only a temporary lull, and after that there was widespread discussion.
Had you listened to the BBC much before the revolutionary event?
Oh yes, always. From during the war, I remember listening to BBC 1944, and then we continued. We always listened to it, and we used to have our New Year's Eve parties. I never forget the marvelous teasing of the BBC of the communist regime, where a young man courts a young lady, and the young lady invites the young man to whisper in my ears and say Stalin, say slowly Soviet Union, which was a very good take-off of the BBC of the tendencies of the time, which was taking place in Hungary, and just seeing the funny sides of this very odd regime which was going on in the 1950s, early 1950s. But yes, I continued to listen to it, and we always did. But basically, what we were trying to do is really trying to be useful, and hence my sort of lorry trip down to the Hungarian border and coming back on it. My parents were quite funny. They said, well, why didn't you straight away go? I said, well, you know, I'm here. There's something happening on to which I'm committed. I can't just leave this. Took a much greater thought and much longer time before the situation arose where one felt that perhaps it was time to go.
But you listen to the BBC for news rather than culture or entertainment.
I listen to news all the rest of the time. Listen to a good-humoured analysis of what was happening in our country. It's really rather nice.
When you first came to the West, was it what you had expected?
Well, I think that as I crossed the Austrian border, that was my very first time that I ever left Hungary. I had never been outside Hungary before. And this German journalist was pointing out to me that the laboratories were working, that they were flushing well, and that the WC system was working rather better than on the Hungarian side. And this didn't apply to our homes, but it was suddenly a change, and the roads were of a better quality. And my grandmother, of course, was a rich lady in the block of flats next to the opera house in Vienna. So certainly it was a different from depressed communist Hungary. And our people were civilized, and it was amazing to enter this the 20th century, leaving this Eastern Bloc, depressed Eastern Bloc country behind. And it was amazing. I was interviewed by the British Council when suddenly 25 places to Oxford were offered to Hungarian refugees in Vienna. And I had no intention of coming to England. I was waiting for the time to go back to Hungary. What I did, in fact, I registered at the medical school in Vienna soon after arrival. And I told them that it is customary in Hungary and in Austria to have a semester at another university. So having registered there, I thought I would spend a semester in Vienna and then I would go back to Hungary. And suddenly friends prompted me that 25 places were offered by the University of Oxford to bring Hungarian students. And I was the only Hungarian student who was interviewed in English. And I never forget that my interview, I asked why do you want to come to England? So I said, well, I didn't really realize that I was coming to England, but if you ask me what attracts me to England, so then we studied English, my favorite writers are George Bernard Shaw and Oscar Wilde. And so Mr. Deakin, who was at that time Vice Chancellor and was interviewing me, said, my dear man, should you be going to Ireland? Which, of course, I didn't realize that these people were Irish. So, subdivisions of the British Isles were unknown to me. But I didn't particularly think of coming to England, but by that time, having stayed even with my Irish grandmother in Vienna, I was getting fed up with being a guest and the opportunity of becoming a subsidized student was very attractive. And we were flown to England on the 26th of November, very early on. The fighting was still going on in Hungary, and some of us felt duly guilty. I mean, it was nice to get away from the fighting, but I mean, our thoughts and hearts were still in Hungary with those who were carrying on with the fights. But at the same time, it was a fantastic comfort to arrive in England. And England was amazingly peaceful. So my grandmother's house was in the Russian zone in Vienna, although the Russians had withdrawn in 1955. Somehow the fact that it was in the Russian zone was still there. On the square nearby, there was the Russian military monument. And one still felt uncomfortable, you know, it was too near. It wasn't certain. The Russians with the military power weren't spent. One somehow wanted to be a little bit further from them. So as we were flying to England, feeling more and more comfortable, but we were still feeling quite paranoid. The chap who translated for my other Hungarians who didn't speak English from Oxford, the chap called Max Hayward, who must have been a kind of a spy or somebody like that, he was an Eastern European expert from St. Anthony College. Well, great intellect, but probably an eccentric of sorts. I remember that he was saying on the plane that, of course, initially we would be interrogated in England for some time. And we were all quite worried, you know, this was not unlikely. You know, if you came from Hungary and somebody was telling you that you were going to be interned and interrogated and that sort of thing, it didn't sound like a joke. It sounded something quite potentially serious and possible. And but I remember discussing it in the plane, he was just making a silly joke. And but we took it quite seriously. And it took us a little while to feel secure. We had a fantastic reception by the British Council. We were put up in a nice hotel in Lancaster Gate. And then 3 days later, we were taken to Oxford. And a really comfortable feeling came when I was taken in by the professor of moral philosophy from Balliol and became a member of his family for a while. And we could discuss philosophy, and I knew about Marxist philosophy. His philosophy was a linguistic philosophy, but of course he knew Marxist philosophy as well. And it was quite interesting suddenly to be in a peaceful and relaxed place like Oxford and discussing philosophy with an English philosopher and being far away from guns, from communism, from the kind of world of darkness at noon of Arthur Koestler and being in a safe and civilized place.
So you started at Balliol?
No, I started staying with this professor at Balliol and stayed then with a lady doctor in Oxford. And then I would have had to do my preclinical studies again if I had stayed in Oxford. So on the grapevine they found that I wanted to get on with my studies and wanted to become a clinical student. I didn't want to waste time. And they formed the University of Newcastle for me. And I went on from Oxford to Newcastle. And I was a clinical student in Newcastle for 3 years. And I was very fortunate with all the help that I had. I qualified at the same time, at the age of 24, as I would have qualified in Hungary. I lost no time.